Okay, we'll get started again. So we left off with the idea that we could add redundancies to single blocks and detect errors, and then either drop the block, if there was an error, either drop the block. Request it to be retransmitted. What we would like to do is to now have some efficient way of correcting errors. Now, you could possibly correct errors by adding redundancies to blocks. You know, just as a thought experiment, think about sending the block 3 times. Okay. Then if 2 of them are the same, that's your block. Okay. So it's not impossible to use redundancy added to a block to do forward error correction. It's just fairly high overhead. Okay. Convolution coding presents a possibly lower overhead, although again, improvement from 1 to 2, 2 to 3, it's not trivial overhead, which allows you to try and correct for errors. We were able to do this because we have not only the bits, but history encoded into the information sent. Okay. So, mathematically, it's non-trivial to understand why convolution codes work exactly. We're just going to look at how you use one. So, again, we are including some historical representation of the data stream. So, any individual portion of that data stream is being encoded a number of times. Okay. Obviously, we can use shift registers to keep that memory. What you get then is a finite state representation of the memory. Apologies, not of the memory, but of the blocks. And as you move from state to state. And so that allows us, good for us, conceptually think of how you generate the code. And then finally, we've generated this code, we have to try and interpret it. And what we do is we take this finite state representation and we sort of unpick it as time goes by, and we need some of these cases with Trellis diagram, and we can examine the path through this Trellis diagram, the error search. Okay. So the best way to understand what's going on is through an example. So in this example, we're going to take in each bit. We're going to generate a 2-bit output, and we're going to use 3 bit plus 2 historical bits to do that. Okay. And so for each of our 2-bit output, it's a function of the current bits we encoded plus 2 historical bits. Okay. And again, in terms of implementation, let's just shift registers. logic. And again, we're doing exclusive ORing on these. Okay. So, we can record our behavior is dependent on our history and on the current bit, and obviously depending on what your current bit is, your history is going to change as, you know, for the next slot it becomes the first historic. So, in this state representation, our history is the two previous bits, and obviously if there's two bits, you can have four possibilities. So 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1. Okay. We then want to encode a bit. The bit you can encode is either a 0 or a 1. So depending on the bit you want to encode plus your history, you get two output bits. So, for instance, if our history is 0, 0, and we input 0, then we'll do get out. 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. Okay, so we get two zeros out. If we want to encode, if our input bit is a 1, then we get 1, 0, 0 is 1, and 1, 0 is 1. So our output is 1, 1. So, for any input, we can pick off the output by following the input through the state machine. Okay, so if we take this path, for instance, we got 1, then output again 1, and if our next output is a 0, we go from B to C, our output is 1, 0. If our next input is a 1, we go back up to B, and our output is 0, 0. So you can travel through the state machine relating input and output. Okay. So that's great because you would think that, again, given the output, again, we can travel through the stage and picking off the inputs. Assuming, of course, that nothing but what you transmitted or what you received is what you transmitted. Okay. So, in our example, our input is 0, 1, 1, 0. So we start at A with a 0, that gives us an output of 0, 0, and it keeps us in state A. Then a 1 gives us an output of 1, 1, takes us to state B. Another 1 gives us an output of 0, 1, and takes us to state D. And our final 0 then gives us an output of 0, 1, and takes us to state C. So that's the encoding. And again, we can use what's called a trellis diagram to look at this visually. And what this trellis diagram is doing is it's just mapping, it's taking time steps as you
go around this state machine. Okay. So we start at state A. From state A, we can either stay in state A, 0, 0, or we can move to state B with an output of 1, 1. Okay. From B, so same thing, and so from state A, it's always the same. You either stay in A with an input of 0 and an output of 0, 0, or you move to B with an input of 1 and an output of 1, 1. You can do the same thing with B. You can either move to C with an input of 0 and an output of 1, 0, or you can move to D with an input of 1 and an output of 0, 1. C, same thing, you can either move to A or B. D, same thing, you can move to C or D. Okay. So if we look at our example, just as we traced it through this state machine, we can now trace it through this trellis diagram. So in our first step, we have 0 in and 0, 0 out. Second step, we have a 1 in, 1, 1 out. Third step, we have a 1 in and a 0, 1 out. And the fourth step, we have a 0 in, 0, 1 out. And that gives us our red path. Okay. So, we can not only look at the input and generate the output, but we can look at the outputs and then infer what the input was. Okay. So if we assume that nothing can be an error, so that what we received is what was sent, then you can pick off the input by knowing the output. So starting to say A, our first output was 0, 0, that meant we had a 0 in. Then we observed 1, 1, that meant we had 1 in. Then we observed 0, 1, that meant we had 1 in. Then we observed 0, 1, that meant we had a 0 in.
Okay. So that's, so assuming no errors, you can see how you go from input to output and then reverse that to go from output to input. So obviously the question becomes, what if there are errors and we want to fix them? Okay. And the answer there is that if there are errors, then they're going to show up in the output. For instance, maybe you don't have a 0, 0 to start out with, then 0, 1. So if it's a 0, 1, you don't know what's going wrong, okay? But what we can do is we can try and determine the likelihood of it having been initially 0, 0 or initially 1. That's not easy to do if you only look at the first stage of your trellis. But if you trace through a number of steps, you can at some point infer that it was more likely to have started out on this one than on this one. And so how do we make that decision? Well, what we do is we look at our output and we ask ourselves how many bits we would have had to change to follow one path versus how many bits we would have had to change to follow a second path. And obviously we want to pick the path that has the least bits changed. Now, you can't follow that path forever. We're trying to make a decision about this first bit, for instance, but you can't just keep going on forever and ever and ever and never making that decision. So you have to look at the paths of a certain length, so you've gone a certain number of steps into the future and then made your decision. So, this method is what's referred to as a perturbing algorithm. It determines what was the most likely path based on, again, how many bits would have had to change in order to travel along that path. And based on that, all you do is select what you think the first input was. So again, we're looking at, you can think of starting as looking at all paths and check how close they are to what you perceive. We can't go on for an arbitrarily long, so we do that for a fixed duration in terms of blocks to be examined. And then we observe that we don't actually need to consider all possible sequences, because again, once you've arrived at a certain state, all you need to consider is the path with the least changes that got you to that state. Okay. So again, that's our this is just writing down our algorithm. So we have a code sequence, and so we examine the first n elements. And at each step, we look at sort of what would be the cost of going one more step along that specific path, which will get us to a certain state, and we trim away anything that's of higher bid. We trim away all but one path to a given state, but one of lowest distance. We stop at some fixed time, and hopefully, then at the time you stop, all of the paths have the same first edge. If so, you decide that that first edge is correct, and correct according to what edge all the paths have. If you still have multiple first edges, and you just decide that you can't fix the error. Okay. And you can do that. And you just repeat that. Okay. So, taking our example again, we have a receive sequence here, and we're trying to decide what the first two bits should have been, and based on that, then what the input bit should have been. We're going to examine seven steps in order to make that decision. So, again, we start in state A, and the only possibilities should be
either 00 for your code or 11 for your code. Instead, we have 10. Okay. But you can either say an A or go to B. In each case, it costs, you know, you have to change one of those bits to do that. So again, if we stop here, we wouldn't be able to draw any conclusions, because it's equally likely could have been one or the other. Now we start again folding in more information by examining the next code, which is 01. Okay, so if you stayed in A, then again you change one to get either A or B. So that would be a total change, you'd have to change two bits. If you were in B, you could go to C. That would be changing two bits for a total of three bits change. Or you could go to D, which actually is correct. That correct code. So at this point, you could be at any of in any of the states. And again, you haven't paired with any initial possibilities. So essentially, what we want to do is we want to get this down to one direction. Okay. Now we look again, and we can get to A from two places. We can get to A from C or from A with 01 is the code. And so obviously from A it costs us 3. Again, from C, it's going to cost us an additional 1 or 3 B from C. We have to add that 4, so we don't consider that. We would have to make more changes to do that. Okay, so we always keep the normal change as. So then let's see what else. So we get to from D, we can get either to C, if we're correct, so we don't add anything, or we can stay in B. Okay, so you keep on doing that. Again, trim away any paths that are bringing you to the same point but with a higher panning distance, a higher cumulative panning distance. And what we see, so significantly, if you're doing step 5 and step 6, we eliminate this top path. Okay. And so there's always a lower cost. We're here, there's always a lower cost option for getting to any. any of the future states. So this cost of 4, and we believe that here it would cost 4, so that doesn't work. Okay. Or we could get here again, but get a cost of 4. Which is more than 4. Okay, now here this would be cost around 1, 1. So this would be cost of 4, this would be cost of 6, actually. Okay, so we've done is you pared away this top branch, and in doing so, we've eliminated again this first option that the first input was 0, 0. And of course, since we have a fixed number of steps we're representing, we move on one further. But when we stop, again, we have at our initial branch, we have a single option. So the conclusion we draw from that is that instead of 1, 0, it should have been 1, 1, taking away B, and 1, 1 corresponds to inputs then of 1. Okay. So we've managed to, first of all, correct the code sequence, and by correcting the code sequence, managed to get the appropriate input value. Okay, so again, that's how these are used. Then you encode your values, and then you examine a certain sequence to see what the most likely, if there's an error, what the most likely value is. Okay. So that's sort of the simplest version. They can get more complicated. I just mentioned turbo coding is based on this idea of encoding sequences, but uses a number of additional techniques. The first one, interleaving, is quite common. So if you think of your stream of data, the first thing is if you have a burst error when you're working out a whole sequence of bits, you'd rather those bits were not logically all together adjacent to each other. And again, think about your code is sort of carrying history, so if everything's adjacent, long enough adjacent like that, you're going to wipe out history as well and not be able to decode. So you take your bits, you, again, think about if you have a certain number, you divide it into a block, and then take strips. Okay, so you're not, the bits you're sending sequentially are not logically sequential, but they're, periodically sampled. Okay. And then puncturing is another technique that's used to try and improve on the, or minimize the amount of data you have to send. We're not particularly going to discuss it. But again, just to say that we typically do some combination of encoding and in order to try and improve the resistance to block errors, to burst errors. So finally, to look at a
example of something that's used in practice. Again, looking at a voice, transmitting a voice stream. And so we are going to be using some sort of model-based encoding of the stream. And we are going to use different encoding techniques depending on sort of, again, the type of data that we're going to present on the stream. So some bits we decide if they don't get there, well, then we're just not going to be able to recreate our signal. So think of those as the parameter bits for this model. And or some of the key parameter values for the model. And so these we're going to use a parity, we're going to use a block encoding schema. And again, this will just detect errors, but if we detect an error in these very important bits, then we're just going to say, well, we don't have a hope of fixing things, so we're going to dump the bits. Okay. We have other bits that are considered to be important, so we combine these with our very important bits and use a convolution coder on them. So, hopefully, again, we can recreate our very important bits and do a decent job of recreating the important bits as well. And then we classify some bits as nice to have, but not crucial. Okay. So, again, depending on quite how important the information that we're transmitting the bits are, we use more or less encoding. Okay.
So, what is day bit?
Sorry?
What is day bit? Is the end of the is that tail of it?
Yeah, I would say it's just an indication of the end.
Yeah,
the sequence. Okay, so there's really nothing more here, just a summary of what I've been saying. There is a multiple block coding, depending on sort of again what surety we need of receiving the bits correctly. And again, if our very important bits can't be recreated properly, then we dump the whole block. And again, for our purposes, it's nice that the ear will smooth over difficulties anyway. Again, we use convolution coding to try and get some error, forward error correction. And again, we're using the bits to not put bits. And these are what, in the example, we had a history of 3, now we have a history of 4. Okay, so what we've seen is, again, we have these two types of coding possible. Block coding can be done with relatively little overhead, but all it can tell you is that there is an error or there isn't. So something like CRC is very good at that. If you care, then you can ask for the data again. If the data is time critical, typically you just have to dump it. Okay. If you want to repair your errors, then you can use the convolution mode to see what you're doing this. They are relatively high overheads. Again, the examples we've seen were sending 2 bits for every 1 input, and those sorts of numbers, yeah, somewhere between 2 to 1, or maybe at best 6 to 5 or something. Typical, so you have a high amount of overhead. But again, you can fix the errors. Okay, we can relate this to our BR and our EB over N0. And again, the thing to note is that if your probability of error is too high, then this encoding actually tends to make things worse because you try and fix things that are essentially just garbage. But encoding will improve your results if you have initial phase is at a reasonable level rather than fix more errors, and since you can fix errors, then possibly less bit energy to transmit and recover your signal. Okay, so our final topic for today is digital modulation, and we're just going to look at sort of, again, some basic schemes. We'll be talking about more sophisticated schemes later in the module. Okay, and so here what we're going to assume is that our signal is carried as a sinusoid, and if you're transmitting as a sinusoid, then there's only 3 things you can change. You can change the amplitude, the phase, or the frequency. There's a lot of low-level hardware details about energy efficiency and ease of building the modulators and demodulators. Okay. So, signal as a sine wave, and we can change the frequency, so the distance between the peaks, the phase, so back and forth, or the amplitude. The other thing that possibly we can do is change how many bits we encode per change. Okay. So, you think about transmitting a single bit, and say you were going to change the frequency, so you need 2 frequencies. What if you want to transmit 2 bits? Well, then you'd have 4 distinct values. You could do it if you had 4 distinct frequencies. Okay. And so, in that case, if you have what's called signaling elements, so something that is fixed for the duration of your signal,
then you can send one or more bits. And so the rate of change in signaling elements is of the signaling baud rate. And then the bit rate is related, but it depends how many bits are being sent at a given time. So if you're sending 2 bits at a time, then our bit rate is twice your signaling rate or your baud rate. So what are some of the possibilities? We have, again, you can change the amplitude. This is not typically used in wireless systems, as it's susceptible to attenuation. So the two that are frequently used are frequency shift keying and phase shift keying. So again, at the simplest, we're sending a single bit, and so you just need two possibilities. So if you did frequency shift keying, you need two frequencies. So you can think of having a carrier frequency and then shifting either up or down from that carrier frequency. And then maybe what distance you maintain is so that the two values don't interfere. Again, there's no reason that you have to stop at transmitting a single bit. You just need to hear the L bits, you need 2 to the L possible changes. Okay. So to transmit 2 bits at a time, you would have to have 4 possible escape frequencies. Okay. And so you can see here we're going from 0, 0 to the top of the range at 1, 1, and then 0, 0. So change happens per 2 bits. Okay, phase shift keying is similar. Here we again change the phase. In the basic version, you have a 180 degree phase difference, and so that's plus and minus. D0 and 1. Again, hardware-wise, you don't like 180-degree phase difference. So, differential phase shift keying uses a change of 90 degrees at a time. Okay, and so that's simpler. So again, here, just an example of the phase shift keying. So we have a carrier wave for basic phase shift keying. You're either going plus or to 0, you flip it and you minus. If it's differential phase shift keying, if you have a 1, you should be forward, back by 90, you should be, back by 90, you should be 0. Zero, and that's relative to the previous element. Naturally, again, you can represent more than one bit per signal. You just have to have, again, 4 distinct phases now. Promise I won't ask you about this, but again, depending on how you implement this, you desirable, and that's if you allow your elements to change at the same time, so that what you want to do is offset the changes that your element changing by 90 degrees at the same time.
Okay, and that's just again an example, but again, if we
get our changes on the degrees. First instance,
and over 90 in a second. Yeah, minimum shift keying, again, this is a method where you get minimum spacing between the frequencies to successfully detect the signal, and it's you can think of it as a special case of our QPSK. Okay, so the final thing to mention about modulation is that the different modulation techniques have better or worse performance relating our EB over N0 to bit error rates. And they also have better or worse performance relative to bandwidth efficiency. So how much can you squeeze into a certain spectrum? Okay. So bandwidth efficiency for each of the systems is different, and again, the gene rates belong to the bit rate, and so that ratio is then sort of how well the system can perform. And it's related additionally to features of the filters that are represented by this value R. And so, again, depending on your filter, what we can do is we can look at this ratio of R over T, and again, the higher that ratio is, the better. And what we can see is that aspect T was pretty well for that, probably has other problems. Frequency shift keying is the ratio is dropping with number of levels, and interestingly enough, phase shift keying the ratio increases with the number of levels. We can then look at the performance in terms of the bit error rate versus the EB over N0. And here we see that for the fixed error rate, they should be usually lower EB over N0 than
can also look at that for according to levels for frequency shifting, and here for the more frequencies you have, the more levels, the better the error rate in the study works.
Okay. So that's all the material. There's a question, a sample problem, a couple sample problems at the end. So what I'd suggest is have a look at this, and I'll start the discussion tomorrow, next Thursday, with some discussion of this and what it means. And then we'll move on again to looking at now specifically the radio link and what factors are there that make radio communication so different from wired communication. So we'll stop there. Like I say, I'll take up with these problems at the beginning of the next lecture. So have a look and have a think about them. And I'll see you next week.